1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 through 17. We're going to begin with a reading of this, and I've got some things I'd like to say in regard to this paragraph this morning, but let's start by reading 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, yet not using your liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. I think this is an important verse for Christians to consider at this point in our lives, in our country's history. And there are many churches, I will say, that completely disagree with what Peter writes here based upon their practice, their view of the world, their view of the Christian's role in society. In fact, there are many religious groups that would tell us that for Christianity to be successful in an era like this, we've got to change the way we do things. We've got to change our thinking. What we're doing now is not working too well, so some things need to be done differently if we're going to succeed and survive in an anti-Christian climate. 40 years ago, a couple of names of men I remember from back then, I don't really know who's leading the charge nowadays because I don't have local TV, I never watch local national news on TV, but back then, Jerry Falwell was a popular religious leader in America. He was a Baptist preacher, but he started a group known as the Moral Majority. Does anybody remember that? The Moral Majority was a political action committee, essentially, comprised of Christians who believed that the way to get change in government that would be more Christian as the result was by organizing Christians into political groups and petitioning the government for change. Another individual back then was Pat Robertson. He had a group called the American Center for Law and Justice, another political action committee. He was a preacher of some kind of denomination, but he believed that for true change to occur, Christians were going to have to organize, they were going to have to politicize, they were going to have to do things differently from the way Peter described in the passage I just read. Here's how Peter described the church in 1 Peter 2, verse 9. He said, "You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, His own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light." But the way many in America read that is this: you are a democratic republic, a political priesthood, a powerful nation, a people whom in God you trust. That's the way many who would claim to be Christians read that. But what Peter says in the passage I read is not on the same page with the thinking that says the church must become a political organization if Christianity is going to succeed in this country. Now, I'm alarmed about the situation in my country. I've been talking about it. I hope, from the perspective of the prophets who spoke out against government corruption, who spoke out against injustice, who spoke out against the persecution of believers by the government. When I've talked about those things from this pulpit, I've simply been trying to echo the things that the prophets spoke about. I do not believe the situation in America is a mortal threat to Christianity. I don't believe that at all. The situation that now exists in this country is exactly the kind of situation in which Christianity historically has not only survived, but thrived. You remember the story of Brer Rabbit telling Brer Fox not to throw him in the briar patch. Whatever you do, don't throw me in that briar patch. Do anything to me. Chop off my head, boil me in oil, do anything you want to me, but do not throw me in the briar patch. And the fox concluded that that's exactly what he was going to do with Brer Rabbit. He threw him in the briar patch, and the next thing he hears is Brer Rabbit laughing. Bred and born in a briar patch. That's the way it is with Christianity. Bred and born amidst government, political opposition, and persecution. And if that's the way it's getting in this country, and it certainly seems it's getting that way in this country, then the stage is being set for the church to succeed like it's never succeeded before in my lifetime. We've got to remember that Peter was living in an environment that was far more menacing and degenerate and threatening to the Christian church than what we're living under today. And what does Peter say in the situation he was in? Verse 13, he says, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." Peter, do you understand what you're saying? Don't you realize you're telling Christians to obey that monster Nero? That megalomaniac who delighted in persecuting Christians? Peter, would you say the same thing you said if you knew that as a result of Nero and Rome's policies, you're going to end up dying, crucified upside down? Would you still say the same thing, Peter? And Peter says, yes, I'd say the same thing. What Peter says is very different from what some churches are saying today. Where does Peter ever talk about Christians, congregations, forming political action committees and forming protest and forming sit-ins and trying to protect individual liberties by political tactics? Where does he say that? Well, he doesn't say that anywhere. It's not to be found. Let me tell you another story about Peter that gives you an idea of the context out of which he was writing. In Acts chapter 12, an apostle is put to death by the government. James is put to death by Herod, the Herod that was in authority in Acts chapter 12, not Herod the Great. And when Herod saw how much the Jews were delighted by the death of James, the Jewish leaders just loved the fact that one of these troublemaking disciples of Jesus has finally got what's coming to him. When Herod saw how happy they were about him putting James to death, he has Peter arrested. So there's a massive show of force when they go to arrest Peter. They send 16 soldiers to arrest him. A quaternion is what the King James says. And he's guarded by four squads of men. A squad was comprised of four soldiers, four legionnaires. 16 men are guarding Peter. They put him in prison. They lock him in there. Herod's going to have his show trial. Now turn back to Acts chapter 12. Let's read just a few verses from here. Acts chapter 12, I'm going to begin reading with verse 6. When Herod was about to bring him out for the show trial, Acts 12, 6, that night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guards before the door were keeping the prison. They had guards everywhere. It's really strange to me how somebody will be arrested these days and put in prison, and the next thing you know, they're dead, and there's no evidence of what happened. I thought they had cameras on these people all the time. It's funny how the cameras always seem to be turned off, or a guard doesn't seem to be around when someone they put in prison ends up dead. But they are guarding Peter. They've got all the eyes on him. And behold, verse 7, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison, and he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise quickly," and his chains fell off his hands. Now that's a funny incident to me. If things had played out the way Herod planned, Peter would have been beheaded the next morning. And here he is that night sleeping so soundly. If you knew you were going to be beheaded tomorrow morning, how would you spend tonight? Peter is sleeping so soundly that when the light is turned on, he doesn't wake up, and the angel's got to kick him in the side to stir him. I'll tell you how I think Peter was able to sleep so soundly. It's because in John 21, Christ told Peter he was going to die when he was an old man, and Peter was not an old man. And I think Peter believed Christ, put his faith and trust in Christ, and he was enjoying a good night's sleep. And so the angel wakes him, and the angel says, verse 8, "Gird yourself, tie on your sandals, put your shoes on." And so he did. And he said to him, "Put on your garment and follow me." And the angel leads him out. The gates open. He walks out into the street. Nobody stops him. And in verse 11, Peter now is outside jail there somewhere in Jerusalem. He's trying to figure out what just happened. And he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent his angel and has delivered me from the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the Jewish people." But now look at verse 12. "So when he had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying." Now, I was shown a house back in May that was supposedly the house of Mary. Tradition says Mary's house was one of the only buildings in town not destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. And so it's sort of been a site that's been acknowledged ever since as where the early church gathered together to pray. And it's a pretty good sized house that I was shown, so many people could have been in there. And so I ask you this question. Peter is delivered by an angel of the Lord. Do you think that deliverance that was wrought in his case was because of Christian flash mobs that appeared outside the prison and began protesting and began chanting? Was it because of political pressure that was brought to bear on Herod by some PAC, political action committee of Christians? Or was it an answer to the prayer that Christians were praying there in verse 12. So when Peter talks about submitting to the government, even when the government is corrupt, he knows what he was talking about. You see, the church has always swung between two extremes. The extreme of alienation, where believers are going to just get away from this corrupt world. We're going to lock ourselves behind the walls of a monastery. We're going to get off in some place where nobody else wants to live, and that's where we'll live, kind of like the Mormons did when they went out to Utah. And so there's the extreme of alienation, and then there's the extreme of absorption, where we adopt the strategies and the tactics and the thinking of those around us. Now, I'm not talking about moral absorption, where we start living the lifestyles of the ungodly around us. I'm talking about we start thinking like they think when it comes to how do you get something done. And of course, the world thinks only in terms of government, political power, and so the church starts thinking that way. And when the church in any generation lays down the weapons given it by God, that creates a void that has to be filled, and it's going to take up other weapons. Now, there's a fight that's going on. And the church needs to be in the fight. Fight the good fight of faith. But how are we going to fight it? The way the world does, or the way the book of God calls us to? Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, I want to read starting with verse 3. Here's what Paul says. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. Can we say that? Paul could say that. But can the church today say that? That we're not walking according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare, we're in a fight, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're not worldly. They're not fleshly. But they are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Now, Paul could say, we're not using fleshly measures, fleshly weapons, tactics to fight a corrupt government. But can we say that? Look at Ephesians chapter 6, verses 17 and 18, where Paul says, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, praying always with all prayer. What were they doing in Acts 12 when Peter's thrown in prison? They have gathered together to pray. Praying always with all prayer and supplication of the Spirit, and taking the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, the proclamation of the Word. The weapons God has given us are prayer and proclamation. And we go as a church beyond that. We've gone too far. I mean, the church is kind of like what they tried to do to David in 1 Samuel 17. Israel and the Philistines are at each other's throat again, and there's this great scene. And having now been there, I wish you could see what I saw of this ridge that runs the length of a field. And at the bottom of the ridge is a little dry creek, and then there's flat farm ground. And in 1 Samuel 17, the Philistines were down there on the flat farm ground, camped. And the Israelites were up there on the ridge. And every morning, the Philistine giant would, the Philistine King Kong would come out of the Philistine camp, a guy by the name of Goliath, over 9 feet tall, and he'd walk up and down cursing Israel, cursing Israel's gods, and all of Israel's up there like they're up in the balcony, just kind of looking down, seeing all this scene. And a young shepherd boy by the name of David shows up, wants to know what's going on, says, why hasn't somebody done something about that unbelieving, uncircumcised big mouth? And he says, if nobody else is going to do something, I will. And Saul says, well, in that case, you need my armor. Now, Saul was the biggest guy there, and I can imagine what David looked like when Saul's armor was put on him. You know, the sleeves are too long, the legs are too long. He looks like the Tin Man, kind of clanking around. And he finally says, this isn't going to work. I can't go out to fight in armor like this. Well, what are you going to use? Well, I'm going to use what I've used every day for I don't know how many years, my sling. That's what I'm going to use. And I'm going to give me some stones. But what David says is, the Lord will fight for us. David's faith and trust was in the Lord. And the church, believers, people today have tried to clad themselves in the armor of God. And folks, it doesn't work. I'm not suggesting we all become Amish. If you want to write a letter to the editor, write it. If you want to run for the school board, do it. And God speed to you in the effort. But that's not what the church, as the church, is about. In Acts chapter 3, Peter and John are going into the temple through a gate called the Beautiful Gate, and there's a crippled man sitting there asking for alms. And Peter says, silver and gold have I none, but what I have I'm going to give you. In the name of Christ, rise and walk. And the man rose and walked. And then there's a famous story of centuries later when the great philosopher and doctor of the Catholic religion, Catholic Church, Thomas Aquinas, was at the Vatican. And the Pope is showing him all around, showing him all the treasures, the gold, the silver, the jewels in the Vatican. And the Pope said to Aquinas, "No longer does the Church have to say, 'Silver and gold have we none.'" And Aquinas replied, "And no longer is the Church able to say, 'In the name of Jesus Christ, arise and walk.'" Aquinas understood how the Church was to behave. The gospel is having greater success today in areas of tyranny and oppression and a lack of civil liberties. The gospel is having greater success in China, greater success in Africa, greater success in Russia than it is having in the Western democracies, where churches are empty or nearly so, and when these groups get together, the sermon lasts for about 10 minutes and Christ is rarely mentioned. They may not have any kind of public praying at all. We're to be constant in prayer, praying with all prayer always, Paul said, proclaiming the word. None of that is done today. And we wonder why we're in trouble. We wonder why we're not having a bigger impact, making a bigger impact. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11 again. Peter says, "This world is not your home, as strangers and pilgrims. This world is not your home, so don't live worldly. Abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul." And then he says, "Your conduct should be so crystal clear in its godliness." There should be such a clear dimension to our living as the children of God that even when people accuse us of doing something wrong, they'll come around to seeing by our good works that God ought to be glorified. By our good works, we've been given prayer, we've been given preaching, we've been given good works to do. And by our good works, we can move unbelievers from accusation to adoration. That's the weapon of our warfare. The principle of verse 12 then, by our good works, is applied in verse 13. Peter, what good work do you have in mind that unbelievers should see in our life? Well, how about obeying the government? Submit yourself to every ordinance of man. Now, Paul picks this up back in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, when he says that there is no authority in this world except that which God allows. Peter agrees with that, 1 Peter 2:14, when he says that the job of government, the way to maintain social order, is by punishing evildoers and praising those who do well. But Peter's point is that not only are Christians to obey the laws, even when the law is against them, we're not only to obey the law because some unbeliever makes a law, we're to obey the law because of our discipleship and faith in and commitment to Jesus Christ. Here's what Christ said about the law. If a man compel you to go 1 mile, that was the law under Roman occupation. If you'd been a Jew living back in Israel at the time of Christ, the Romans were in charge, and it was a Roman law that at any time a Roman soldier, a legionnaire, could come up and order you to carry his luggage for 1 mile. And so to obey the law, you pick up his luggage, no matter how heavy it is, no matter how many pieces there are, and you carry it for a mile. But when you got to the last inch of the mile, you could put it down and walk away because you had kept the law. You'd obeyed the law. But Christ said, if you're compelled to go a mile with that man, you go with him too. And it's in that second mile that legionnaire is going to see something different. that legionnaire is going to see a good work that might get him thinking, that might get him wondering why you're going two when you only have to go one. That might get him asking some questions about the hope that is within you. And when he does, you talk to him about Jesus Christ. And that might move, that second mile might move him from accusation to adoration. Acts chapter 16. Paul and Silas have been thrown in jail unjustly. They have been stripped. They have had the tar beaten out of them. They are in an inner cell in a black hole, a pit with no light whatsoever. Their feet are in stocks. And you know what they do? They don't get on the phone and call some Christian political action committee. They start singing. They start singing. And in response to their singing, they have a song service at midnight in that hole in the ground there in Philippi. In response to that singing, the Lord sends an earthquake and their chains shake off. The jailer, who's been asleep, is awakened. And he realizes what's happened, thinks that the prisoners have escaped. He is getting ready to kill himself. And Paul shouts out, No, we're all here. Don't hurt yourself. And he gets him a light and he goes in and he sees that they are all there. As a result of Paul and Silas having a song service at midnight in that jail, they had a baptism before the night was over. Prayer, proclamation, singing, speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, submitting the good work of submitting. Those are the tools that God has given the church of God. And those are the tools that the church should be concerned with. Now, churches today, many of them are thinking, you know, what we should have done for Paul is make sure we get a Christian jailer appointed to that position. We need to make sure that we elect a Christian magistrate who would never have Paul thrown in jail to begin with. But that's not the way God did it. God allowed the tar to be beaten out of his servant. God allowed an injustice to be done. And by it all, a man was saved. How big was the crowd at the foot of the cross when the greatest victory that was ever won was won by Jesus Christ? The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they are mighty. And God will answer if we will use those weapons. So we can do it God's way as a church by submitting, by obeying the law, or we can do it man's way. God's way is the way of purpose and power and victory. Man's way is superficial. It's transient and it's weak. It won't last very long. We need to do it God's way. We're worried that if we don't do something, maybe paganism will take over. Maybe Islam will step in. How are we going to face those threats? And they are real threats, real possibilities. We're going to do it by prayer and by preaching and by singing, and by obeying. And we're going to put our trust in God, our faith in God, that He will bless our efforts, our worship, consistent with what the Apostle Peter wrote.